The Parkland Hour Podcast, unscripted conversations with the people at the heart of Parkland College.
Welcome to the Parkland Hour Podcast, the show where we talk with the people who make Parkland College a great place to work and study. My name's Tom Ramage. I'm the president of Parkland College, and I'm joined at the table by my colleagues, Derek Baker, who's the Dean of Learning Support, Stephanie Stewart, Vice President for Communication and External Affairs, Mike Coulter, our video production specialist slash dog walker slash cultural aficionado, among other things. But before we get started, I'm going to ask each of them to talk a little bit about some news or a little segment we call Quickfire, what's going on at Parkland College in the next few days to a month or so, before we get the conversation started with our guest. So I think we're going to start with Ms. Stewart.
Well, wonderful.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Good afternoon. Good evening.
All of the above.
Depending on when you're listening to this.
Well, I suppose.
Yeah.
It's all about you.
So my quickfire today is about some new career and technical education bridge courses that we have that are new in adult education. We have new programs that can bridge individuals who either need ESL services or are not completers of high school quite yet into our health careers programs, industrial technology, and our business management track of different courses. And so those courses start March 9th, but people can come in at any point in the remainder of the semester to get started on that bridge. Once you complete the bridge, you can go right into academic coursework, and so it's a great on-ramp for individuals that may not have finished high school, but they want to get started.
And well-named.
Very well-named.
Bridges.
Bridges.
Fabulous.
Makes perfect sense.
Now, is that open entry, or does that only start on Monday, on March 9th?
It's open entry, okay. So you can come anytime after that and begin those courses. And so it's a really flexible way to get back in the groove if you've been out of school for a while, but you're wanting to come back. It's a really great expansion, too. In the past, we've only offered bridges in the CNA program and in welding. And so now we have a whole wide array of options for different career paths. So that's a new...
How does that work logistically? I'm just curious. Like, if you can come in anytime... I mean, is it like any day or is it any week and you just kind of catch up or do they work on your level? I don't know, honestly.
Yeah, so you come into adult education, it's about a 2 or 3 hour appointment, and so you go through some assessments and you work with them and they learn a little bit about your academic history and where you are, and then you begin those courses, and they're a little bit broad. So let's say you want to go into a business field, it's going to offer you some coursework that's contextualized for business, but then you could go into a more specific career later on.
That's awesome.
So it's pretty individualized.
Who do you talk to get started in that program? Do you know?
You can contact Parkland Adult Education, and I'll go ahead and give you the phone number. It's 351.
Hold on, let me write it down. 351.
25. 8. 8. 0. 0. 0. Yeah.
All right. That's too many numbers. 351.
How many zeros was that?
That's too many.
That's not how people read phone numbers. Yeah. You realize that, right?
Should be like 1-800 and spell a word or something.
Just 351-2580, or you can email adulteducation@parkland.edu, and you just schedule an appointment and come in, and then they get you started.
Beautiful.
Hey, I'm Mike Coulter. I got two little quick things. One, Chris and I are big baseball fans. So I just looked it up. Parkland, I think Parkland baseball is number 16 now. They've been playing, but I mean, obviously farther south from
Mississippi.
Here. Yeah, Mississippi, and I think they were in southern Illinois, maybe, where it's slightly warmer. But it's been pretty good this week. But just remind everybody, it won't be long till they'll be playing out on the Parkland fields, and it's a really good team, and you should go out and watch them. And then the other thing, if you're a faculty member at Parkland and listening to this, which I'm sure every faculty member is, and staff, whatever. In the Center for Excellence, the hub, we call it, just where you walk in the door. I just wanted to just give a little thing. It's really great. Like in the mornings, like today I went down and Matt Hurt and Derek Dallas and Amy were just talking about students and classes and stuff. But just we have different flavored coffee. Sometimes this week they brought in industrial donuts 2 days a week. So just grab some coffee and help yourself. And if somebody's around, just talk to them about your job or anything. It's just kind of a nice little get together.
Start the morning off.
Yeah,
right.
Dean Geiken brings in different flavors of coffee every day, and it's just kind of nice if you don't have anything in the morning and you just want to talk to a colleague, just stop in. It's really kind of nice.
Very cool. Do you know when the first home baseball game is?
I do not. Tom,
well, now I'm going to have to Google something. Talk amongst yourselves.
No, I can look it up.
I was also going to mention the basketball teams, both the men and the women's, won their games. So they're advancing to the next, whatever the next round is this weekend. They play on Saturday.
I believe, if I'm not mistaken, we have six former Parkland baseball players in the big leagues right now. Most of them pitchers, one outfielder.
Yeah, Kiermaier's the outfielder.
Right, he's at Tampa Bay.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Golden Glove last year or the year before, I think it was.
Oh, he's not a terrible offensive player, but...
And he's a nice guy. He was here for our Athletic Hall of Fame a couple of years ago.
Yeah, that's awesome.
Good deal.
Very good. Well, my quick fire today is March 11th is, I don't know if it's Giving Day or Day of Giving.
Probably both.
So it referred to in both ways. Mm-hmm. But I also remember seeing something in the mail that referred to it as Spirit Day or something to that effect. So I don't know what they're calling it. But on March 11th, it's a day to show your Parkland spirit and to contribute to the foundation. Last year, they said they raised $70,000, which is a lot of money to raise.
It's incredible.
In one day.
One day, yeah, 24 hours.
You can give online. There's just a link for it, and you can just go right in and type it in. It was very easy to give last year.
So would you just, like, Google Parkland Day of Giving? Is that how you find it?
Or I think I actually found the link on Facebook, and I just followed that.
I'm sure they'll be sending things out about that. But I was curious. I didn't have a chance to look this up because, you know, we do put in so much show prep for this, but I didn't have a chance to actually look up how much we give in scholarships. But
are you trolling me, Derek?
No, not at all. I was curious if anybody knew how much we gave in scholarships last year. It's not a trick question.
Do you know the answer?
I don't. That's why I'm asking.
Oh, yeah. So it's just under $250,000.
Right here.
Just under $250,000 goes out of the foundation in endowed gifts, named scholarships, private and otherwise, every year.
Yeah. And about how many scholarships is that? Do you know?
Oh, that's a good question.
Okay. Well, it's a lot of money, though.
It is.
For students. So anybody that wants to can participate in that day of giving and be a part of that. And also, aren't they putting out a new application online? I don't think it's ready yet.
Yes.
They're working on that. And it's going to be a really streamlined process, much easier for students. So we should be on the lookout for that to roll out soon.
And also, I just finished my show prep as well. It looks like we're playing Indian Hills Community College of Centerville in Champaign, and that'll be March 11th on Wednesday, and then March 15th against Heartland here. So a lot of games coming up.
So March 11th is a big day.
Yeah, and it's a really, really nice thing there. It's really nice out there. March 15th, March 11th, yeah. So get out and see the Parkland Cobras. Maybe see a future Hall of Famer.
Maybe.
So the number of scholarships, it just occurred to me, right around 332 scholarships, and it's just under 300K, so I was close with $250,000. So
good.
It's good to be sitting near a computer where you can look stuff up. So I have one, too. And it's a little early. April 24th is Arbor Day, and Parkland's typically done something special on Arbor Day. We have a memorial grove on campus that's been here for, well, almost as long as the campus has been in existence, since about 1970-something, late 70s. A faculty member by the name of, her name just escaped my head. I'll have to come back. Mary Lee Sargent, there it goes,
yes.
Started the memorial grove. And on Arbor Day since then, we've been planting trees in honor of special people in the lives of staff and faculty at Parkland College. Actually, there's a tree out there that's in memory of my dad. So what we do is plant a tree. It's about a $500 donation to the Parkland College Foundation. It's called a living gift, where you can remember a friend or a loved one, alive or not, with a plaque and a tree of your choice that's planted out in Memorial Grove. It's kind of a nice thing to do. We'll have a little ceremony. April 3rd is the deadline for getting that in. Susan Goldstein and the Foundation at 351-2464 will be glad to talk about how to go about getting involved in that.
That's pretty cool.
That's kind of cool.
I mean, do you go out and look at? I mean, I'm assuming you check on your tree every so often, right?
You know. It's the one that I'm interested in particular is right on the edge of the drive where Bradley and the Perimeter Road meet, so I can actually drive the road and see the tree without actually getting out of the car, which is kind of cool.
Oh, that's awesome. Yeah.
Just luck of the placement.
Yeah.
But kind of neat. We have a guest, John Moore. Did you know Mary Lee Sargent?
Yes, I did.
Of course you did. Why does John Moore know Mary Lee Sargent? Well, John is the... currently the longest-serving Parkland faculty member still working today. He started at Parkland College in 1980 after doing a number of other things, yes, that I'm sure we'll talk about. But John has been teaching anatomy, head and neck anatomy for dental hygiene, surgical anatomy for our surg tech program, cat anatomy for the vet tech program, pathophysiology, radiological cross-section anatomy for our rad tech program. He's the lead instructor for Forensic Science 2. It's called Death Analysis. The prefix is SCI and the number is 208. We'll talk a little bit about that. And he's also scheduled in this next academic year to teach flight physiology for our Institute for Aviation, which I had no idea about until I saw this. Well, that's very cool.
Well, thank you.
What is flight physiology?
Yeah. We're going to get to that.
Oh, I'm sorry. Sorry, I'm just so curious. I got to know.
You come to college and you learn things. Isn't that amazing?
Wow.
Even if you're not, I'm not bird anatomy or something.
Yeah.
Oh, well,
yeah.
What the heck? Let's talk about it. John, what's flight physiology?
Well, one of the big problems is if you get above, for most people, get above 5,000 feet and you get to a lower density of the atmosphere, you start having some physiological issues. Most of us who take commercial airline flights and whatnot, we're flying in a pressurized cabin. Even then, first of all, most of us at least have heard of Denver, Colorado, the nickname being?
Mile High City.
Mile High City and everything. Okay. Most commercial airliners are pressurized to an altitude of 8,000 feet. So most of us are used to at least being to an altitude of 8,000 feet and whatnot. And that doesn't bother us. We might have some ear popping and so on if we take off and go to that. The issue is, though, that most of those airliners are flying at 35,000 feet. So they're pressurized to 8,000, but we're flying at 35,000 feet and everything. So there's this pressure difference. The big concern you see from watching movies and TV shows and stuff like that is, at least in the old days, what happens if somebody sneaks on board, sneaks a gun in there, and they shoot out a window at 35,000 feet? There is the term that everybody worries about, which is explosive decompression. And so suddenly everything gets sucked out of the window because there's this big pressure differential and whatnot. And so to the average person, that's the big thing that they are worried about is the
explosive. Well, now I am.
I haven't really thought about that.
Yeah.
side note here.
But that's real, right?
That is a real concern.
Clear and warranted in our concern for that.
And I have to tell you, one of the spookiest moments teaching that course, last semester, we're in the portion of the Science 208 class where we're talking, there is a sub-portion of the course where we talk about airline issues in terms of plane crashes and explosive decompression and stuff like that. And somebody asked the question, well, where's the safest place to sit in an airliner and so on and so forth. And so I said, well, you know, it actually depends on the plane and do they have the engines at the rear? Do they have the engines on the wing and so on? So I said, if you're flying the plane that has the engines on the wing, stay away from seats by the wing. And because there's some, you know, planes have situations with the engines and there's a turbine in there spinning at many, many, many thousands of RPMs. And you don't want to have what is called an uncontained engine explosion, where pieces of the engine come out and could possibly go into the fuselage of the airplane. Okay, so we're talking about that, and
now you've given me two things to worry about.
Yeah. Okay, it's going to be a very fascinating.
Seat selection is more important than ever.
That night, I get home.
Oh no!
That is the night that Southwest Airlines had an uncontained engine explosion. It hit the window. The woman gets sucked out, partially out. I mean, it. The night that I gave the lecture, what I was lecturing on happened.
That's spooky.
That is spooky. That was an interesting issue.
So we should be careful what we talk about here today.
Yes. So, yeah.
I feel like there was a movie with this same premise where the characters would have, I can't remember what. Do you know what I'm talking about? I can't remember the name of the movie. I start these lines of inquiry and then can't finish them without Google.
Is it the one where Bugs Bunny just jumps out right before the plane crashes and then doesn't get hurt?
No.
Because that doesn't work.
My mind immediately went to snakes on a plane. But
anyways, so there is, you know, that's the issue that the general public has is explosive decompression and so on and so forth. from the point of view of the future pilots and everything, the real concern there is a slow decompression that is, for whatever reason, is not picked up by the pressure sensors in the cockpit. And so what is known as high altitude hypoxia. Hypoxia is the same thing as what you folks have heard about as carbon monoxide poisoning. It happens slowly, you don't realize it's happening, and you basically lose consciousness and pass out. And when that happens to your flight crew,
not great.
Not great.
Yeah.
And you guys can help me out here. 4, 5, 6 years ago, there was a golfer.
Payne Stewart.
Thank you.
Yeah.
You are a step ahead of me, Tom.
Just Googled it, John.
Okay. Something happened. The plane had a slow leak in terms of its pressurization. The flight crew lost consciousness. Everybody in the plane lost consciousness. I want to say they were over South Dakota.
It's exactly it. 1999, they were in a Learjet. 4 passengers, 2 crew. Payne Stewart was among them. Yeah, I remember that vividly.
And they sent a chase plane up there, and along with the depressurization of the cabin will come some changes in the humidity. And so they had frosted over the windows, and the chase plane had a difficult time seeing inside. But they knew exactly what had happened, and there is nothing that they can do. Now, what would have been interesting, because they were in a very non-populated portion of the country, they basically just had to wait for the plane to crash. Yeah. Which, what would have been interesting, and I don't know what the protocols and policies are in big cities, but what happens if this is coming into a place like LA or something like that? Are there some interesting protocols there? And I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, if it's heading towards a populated region.
Yeah, I would imagine there would be.
So, that is part of flight physiology, is the altitude-related hypoxia. There are changes that occur in your vision. Your color vision is the first to go. And so designers of cockpit instrumentation know this, and so there is something special about the color of all the gauges and everything. But even then, as you start to have changes in the oxygen levels associated with planes, are you reading the gauges properly? Mm-hmm. There is the inner ear equilibrium. What happens if the artificial horizon on your gauges is giving you something different than what your ear is telling you? What does the human brain want to believe? Does it want to believe the gauge on the dash? Does it want to believe what it is receiving from the biological aspect of it? And so, again, there is equilibrium part of flight physiology. There is the visual aspect of it. There is the whole bit about positive and negative G-forces. Again, the whole aspect of this is very much a part of flight. And then there's the planes that do have and do not have pressurized cabins.
Have you taught this course before, John?
No.
No, first time.
But much of it, I shouldn't say much of it, a significant portion of it is pulled out of my pathophysiology course, the forensics course, and just the fact that I've always had an interest in it, and talk about how things come around. When I finished graduate school and was looking for a job, one of the places I had picked up an application for was the U.S. Air Force. And what they were looking for was someone to teach flight physiology. And so I can't remember at the time why I ended up not applying for that position, but I was actually considering applying for a position as a flight physiology instructor, and here it is 40 plus years later, and I am going to turn around and end up teaching flight physiology. You know, there's just a slight delay in there to come around and do it.
So I know you probably, you know, I'm telling you, but I mean, do you give them practical things where, I mean, do they have simulators where you can do this?
Or? Oh, out there, they have, okay, they don't have simulators there for the hypoxia, but if these people go on and become commercial pilots, they will go through hypoxic simulation. And this is something, you can go ahead and Google this. You can watch people in a hypoxic simulator what happens when you start lowering the oxygen level and the stupid decisions you start making. And this is one of the key things. It's just like, once again, it's like carbon monoxide poisoning. You don't necessarily know it's happening to you. It's like certain aspects of drunk driving. Oh, I can drive okay. I'm not inebriated or something to that effect. The same thing happens with slow onset hypoxic conditions, low oxygen conditions. And so there's all sorts of stuff you can look up in Google about people going through hypoxic training for commercial flight ratings.
Including watching the movie The Officer and a Gentleman.
There you go.
There's a nice component about that in there.
Yeah.
In case anybody was looking for a source.
So just like you go through
training. I watch it for the romance, sir.
Yeah, I would clearly, you know, clearly. Yeah.
So just like you can go through training that teaches you how to deal with G-forces.
Yeah.
And how to deal with the redistribution of blood to your feet or your head, blackouts versus redouts and things like this. There is, you know, the whole hypoxic condition, the low oxygen condition. So, and that's something to be concerned about.
So is there an actual strategy for what, like, do you respond to it in a certain way?
In terms,
or is it done if that happens?
In terms of the G-forces, you can train yourself to do things. In terms of the hypoxic condition, what you need to do is get to your oxygen mask as soon as possible. And even then, there are certain types of oxygen masks. Certain types work up to a certain altitude. Past a certain altitude, you actually have to have a positive pressure oxygen mask that actually forces oxygen at a positive pressure into your bloodstream and whatnot. And so, again, that gets complicated. So once you're above 26,000 feet, you're going to have a different type of mask than between 10,000 and 26,000 feet, and so on and so forth. Yeah.
Interesting. Go ahead.
Oh, so how has, you know, you have this deeper knowledge, right, of kind of all the things that could go wrong, right? Mm-hmm. That you're really being able to describe that to potential pilots and pilots that we're training. How has that impacted the way that you travel?
Do you
and
fly?
The things that you think about when you fly, or do you fly?
Do you carry you a CPAP machine areas. With you when you go, too?
My big concern in terms of when I fly is I carry a smoke hood. Which is something you pull over, and it gives you an extra 2 minutes of air to breathe to get off the plane. If the plane goes down, and there is so much plastic that gives off so much smoke and cyanide and other toxic things that if you survive the crash and there's fire, that's the big thing, is surviving the smoke and getting off and everything, is having a smoke hood with you.
Okay.
And so just to summarize,
I'm going to add that to my Amazon cart.
All the things we have to worry about when we fly, the engine could explode, we could get sucked out the window, the pilot could lose consciousness,
the toilet could overflow.
Well, you haven't mentioned that one yet, okay. The toilet could overflow.
Yeah.
We could inhale the smoke on the way down, or we could die in the crash.
Mm-hmm.
So, okay, just to make sure I got all those.
You don't wear the smoke hood, like, there until you need it, right?
Correct.
Like, you don't get on, like, the Grim Reaper. It's like, holy God, he's got a smoke hood on.
And actually, someone threw out the question, generally, with one or two exceptions, I don't fly anymore. But the reason being, most of the places I go for firearms training, and TSA has torqued me off so much to the point where I will just drive nowadays. And rather than put up with TSA to try and travel with both firearms and ammunition and stuff like that.
Yeah.
But I will say that last year my wife and I met out in Las Vegas and got remarried. And so I flew out to that. And Elvis is still alive. He remarried us. And it was wonderful. I highly recommend it.
That's awesome.
It was well worth the exorbitant amount of money they charge to have Elvis remarry you.
But the photos are priceless.
Very interesting.
Oh, they are. They really, really are. So,
excellent.
John, you taught me the words forensic and osteology and put them together. You're the first person I ever heard those words from. You're somewhat of an expert in this field.
Well,
they know you in multiple states, and you've had some experiences.
People call me into certain cases. Yeah, okay. Osteology is the study of bones. Forensics is relating to police or court cases, and most people see enough forensic shows on TV and whatnot. Starting right when I first got here full-time in 1980, there were a series of, there was a large series of courses offered by the National Science Foundation called the Chautauqua Series, made available to college instructors, highly skewed towards community college instructors and whatnot. And there were tons of them. There were for physics instructors and math instructors and a lot of geology instructors and whatnot. And the closest there was for someone who had a background in anatomy, which is what my training area was forensic anthropology. This was done by a gentleman down at University of Tennessee at Knoxville who started the body farm concept.
With the FBI, right?
And Dr. Bill Bass, yeah. And so Parkland was kind enough to fund me to start going to these short courses. Now, these short courses ran anywhere from 3 or 4 days up to some of them were 1 to 2 weeks. I started going at the UTK. Some of them then went to a place, Mercyhurst College in Pennsylvania, who was taught by someone who was a doctoral graduate student from Bill Bass. And so at that time, there was no degree in forensic anything. The forensic word was not used back in the 80s. Actually, back in the 70s, I started working for the Grand Rapids Police Department, and it was just called the Crime Lab, because that's all it was called back then. And so I simply, over the years, in summer, usually between the end of spring semester and the beginning of summer semester, would take some short courses. And then wait a year or two, take some more short courses. And so when I sent my bio to Tom, I told him, there's not a single forensics course on any official transcript that I have. It's all these short courses that I took at various colleges. Now, some of these are some interesting places. Armed Forces Institute of Pathology, okay, the Body Farm.
Can you describe the body farm? So what does that encompass? What's there, and what do you get to interact with versus what they're storing for evidence or other purposes?
The part that most people see on the TV shows is the part most people want to hear about. It's an area of 3 or 4 acres where at any given time there are plus or minus about 200 human bodies decomposing. Some are buried, some are out in the open, some are hanging from trees, some are underwater, some are in the trunk of a Buick, some are in a 55-gallon drum, some are in a small building they built, some are in cut up in suitcases, some are just all the different ways that police might find human bodies decomposing, they are there.
You're describing my uncle's house, by the way.
So okay.
Go ahead.
Yeah.
any airplanes?
No airplanes.
They could really blend the two.
Mike, we're going to just let that pass.
No, we're going to make a comment. Yeah, I won't mention his name.
Is this what happens when you donate your body to science? You could end up in a cadaver lab
if you do it in Tennessee, you could, and there is a waiting list to go to the body farm.
To visit or to
end up there.
You're serious.
I kid you not.
Wow.
People want to do that. Now, basically what this means, and people say...
everybody's trying to wrap their head around that. Why would people help? Do you know why people would want...
Is it just kind of like a cool factor?
There is probably a morbid fascination to this. Hmm. And where did Uncle Bob go? Well, right now he's 2 months into being at the body farm, you know, or something like that. But the way I explain it in the Psi 208 class is this. If UPD, the Urbana Police Department, if they find a body out in Busey Woods, okay, and it's pretty far along in the decompositional process, what they can possibly do is they'll take some photos of it. They'll also take some samples because they can look at the chemical process of decomposition. But they'll take some photos. They'll send those photos to and there are several body farms now. There's not just one like there was in the beginning. They can send those photos down there along with the previous year's weather data, what the temperature was, what the humidity was, and so on and so forth. And using that, based on what they have learned down at the body farm over all that time, what they can do is say, well, we can give you a window that says that body has been there between 6.5 and 7.5 months.
because they have a direct comparison.
And they now have a window to look at as to when that body was placed there.
And is that actually the accuracy, plus or minus 30 days?
It totally depends on a zillion variables, and the weather throws a lot depends on, they use something very similar to heating degree days and cooling degree mm-hmm. days in terms of how you calculate right. that. And that window expands and contracts depending on where you are in the calendar and how many heating and cooling degree days you're looking at because of that. Also, so much depends on the body. Bodies with high degrees of body fat decompose differently mm-hmm. than thinner bodies. And so the body mass index...
Sure. You've had some, you've been called mm-hmm. on a number of occasions, locally?
Locally and from around the state.
Tell us an interesting story.
Okay, one of the interesting stories, first of all, I did not know that there was a place up north called Ogle County. Okay, I'd never heard of that county. We, and let me stop and say who we is. There is a retired professor from U of I, Linda Kleppinger, who is a board-certified forensic anthropologist. So her background and training is much deeper and more significant than mine. She and I, over the years, have worked several cases together. There was I guess you would call it a cold case. It was from 49 years ago, and for some reason there was some interest in that. So they exhumed the body, opened up the casket, and someone up there, I don't know the details on this, took the remaining flesh from the body and defleshed the bones, because those of us that are osteologists, we only work with bones. We don't do the flesh part. And so they then sent the skeletal remains down here, and Linda and I looked at it, and long story made short, the skull, the head that was in the casket, did not belong to the remainder of the body that was in the casket.
Dun, dun, dun.
Oh my goodness.
Wow, that's crazy.
Now, we wrote up our report, we submitted that, and somehow that report leaked out. It got to some newspapers in Chicago, and boy, were we getting a lot of phone calls about it. They wanted us to, or I don't know if they wanted, I assume they contacted Linda as much as they contacted me here. I can't remember if it was 2020 or one. They wanted to go on, and you don't do that. You submit your report, that's it, and life goes on, you know.
So what happened? What was the outcome of this?
There was no outcome.
There wasn't. It just that there was that head didn't match the body.
Did not. Well, I can add this to it. A year later, a sheriff in that same Ogle County was driving along a roadside and noticed something white and spherical in a ditch. Pulls over. It is a
volleyball.
Human skull.
Wilson.
And that skull ends up coming back down here as well. And by the way, these things are analyzed here in Parkland's lab. So these analyses are done here. This, because of the age and everything, was not an ongoing open case, so there wasn't a lot of legal detail to it. On some of the open case, actual ongoing cases, in order to maintain the chain of evidence and things like that, we will actually pull the lock cores from the lab and change it over to a lock that only I have access to, and I will then go ahead and work on it. And so that way I know that I have the only chain of evidence mm-hmm. in terms. So, you know, we've done some serious stuff here. But anyways, we bring that skull down here, and long story made short on that one, is that skull did not belong to the body that was in that casket. So in Ogle County...
Stay away from Ogle County.
Stay away from Ogle County, because there are two heads up there that we don't know the body to.
All right, airplanes and Ogle County, I got it.
And a body that we still don't have a head for.
And so something, something, two heads not being better than one this time.
Yeah.
Somebody else write the joke. I'm just throwing that.
So when that, when those sorts of artifacts, pieces of evidence come, and you said you use the Parkland labs for that. Is that something that our students have an opportunity to to work with, or is it just something that you're doing?
But we do have some other stuff. There is a skull that they get to see and handle and, for that matter, analyze somewhat that was pulled out of a dumpster. There used to be a Kmart in Urbana. And
going to that Kmart.
And people, they when they closed it down, they didn't take the dumpster away from it. And so people in the area were using it to dump their personal trash there and whatnot. And so the police sent an officer, young rookie officer, over there to try and look for names in the trash to try and start writing tickets for it. Okay, as he's going through the trash, he finds this old burlap bag with a human skull in it, and that worked its way through the chain of things, and eventually we now have that skull. We've had it for the last 10 years, and that is something we use for teaching purposes. That is most likely what is called a trophy skull. Some military, when they are getting ready to come back from wherever they are deployed, want evidence of the fact they were involved in some sort of interaction, and they bring body parts back. And this has all the characteristics of being a trophy skull. The problem is, when they bring it back, they would like to display it at their residence, and the family tends to not like that. So what gives this one away is they had used it for a candle holder, and there's wax all over it.
Wow.
So were you involved in the CSI summer camp thing we had going on last summer?
Yes.
With so that's high school students.
Are we talking about the College for Kids program?
And so I think it's the one a little higher than College for Kids. Though. It's like the high school kids.
Very good, very good.
It's got a special name.
Yeah,
right?
It's that next age group.
Yeah,
yeah,
yeah.
I hope so.
We had a 55-gallon drum with some skeletal elements in it that they had to. It had some drying elements in it, so they had to dump it over in lab and get the bones out and lay them out. Yeah, so they did some stuff last summer.
Okay, I know this isn't a technical question, but just in general, because I know you deal with this a lot. Why do you think, and maybe it's just me and I have a weird group of friends, but it seems like in the last 15 years, 10 years, people read more true crime things, they watch more true crime things. Do you think it's just because it's on TV more? Or what do you think the fascination with this is now?
It's got to be the TV thing.
Do you think it's gotten bigger than what it was though back in the day, for sure?
But I also think there's also been a saturation aspect to it. We used to run some national workshops here at Parkland where we would educate some other college instructors and some coroners and some people about forensic osteology. There was a big peak to that, and then part of it was, I think, at the time, the economy. Part of it was, I think, a saturation phenomenon, and that sort of went away, and so we've stopped doing that. But for a while, there was a big interest in it, and we used to run a yearly workshop here that I did, and that has since gone by the wayside and whatnot. But there, I think at the public level, there still is that fascination. And I'm glad at least the commercials on TV have kind of backed off a little bit about the new Forensics 2 show.
I mean, but do you think it's bad for the court system, like jurors, knowing just a little bit about it?
From what I hear, people could come in and you can be on jury duty for a parking ticket and they want to have some forensic evidence on it. You know, and literally that has been given the name, the forensic effect. And
So there's two courses in the series, right?
Psy 108 and Psy 208. Christina Beatty teaches the Psy 108, which is more trace evidence, fingerprint, microscopic-related stuff. I teach the Psy 208, and we do ballistics, explosives, forensic osteology, forensic odontology with the teeth. We do motor vehicle accidents. We do plane crashes and
blood spatter patterns.
Blood spatter. Yeah. Yes, exactly. And so they are not linked. You don't have to do one before the other. You can do them concurrently. You can do the 208 first, the 108, whatever works into the student's schedule. And a lot of students aren't even, they're not criminal justice students. I'll have psych majors. I'll have education majors. A lot of people just take it because they find out what it's about. Yeah.
A question about another class that you was on your list that you teach. So you teach cat anatomy.
Well, right? I used to. Oh. It's now taught internally within the vet tech program. But yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, I was curious. That seemed very specific, first of all, like cats as opposed to other animals. And I was wondering why cats, like why that animal in particular?
Most of the vet techs are going to work with, unless they're going into a large animal practice, and we wouldn't want to be getting cows or horses bodies to have to store here. So
we'd have a space issue.
Yeah. So basically, the muscle and vascular systems for the cat and the dog are the same, and so it's just, that's one of the easiest animals to get. And if you know the cat anatomy, you pretty much know the dog anatomy. And those are the two main animals that in a common practice that isn't large animal, those are the animals that the vet techs are going to need to know is cat and dog.
So as a young kid, I remember my mom being in a nursing program at a different community college, and her part of her curriculum was to work on a cat, mm-hmm. a cat cadaver. Mm-hmm. So that's fairly popular in multiple programs. Does that still happen in nursing? Or maybe it was a pre-nursing, a gen ed that was part of the program.
You know, a lot of programs in that time period, cat anatomy was the way to go.
Very good.
Yes. And it gets the concept across. It obviously doesn't get the specific anatomy across. Yeah.
I see a medical legal death investigation training program certificate.
Yeah.
In your materials. What is a medical legal death investigator?
That's part of a national certification through, I want to say, the National Institute of Justice or something to that effect. I've got the quote paperwork part. I did the online testing for it and all this and that. Now what happens is someday, if I ever retire, if I can get the actual hours under my belt, which would mean if I went and either got hired or volunteered with coroner's office to get the second portion of that, then I would be literally nationally certified to be a death investigator at the national level.
And what is a death investigator? Like a coroner?
It's the equivalent of a coroner.
Very good.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So I've got a question, so we can get off the bones and everything. You talked about taking guns and everything. Can you tell us a little bit about that? As part of your life, you said you didn't fly with your guns. You said you were going to different things. What's that about?
For whatever reason, maybe it's growing up on the south side of Detroit, I don't know. I have been into, the joke around here with some of our law enforcement people and in public safety, I probably have more tactical firearms training than most of our cops. I started in the 80s, and I've been around the country to firearms training at a lot of places that train anywhere from police to, well, again, all the alphabet people, the governmental places and whatnot. And so I have a lot of training with handgun, rifle, all the way up to submachine gun. Yeah. So you walk in my office and there's a target with my last submachine gun shooting. Yeah.
Oh, that's pretty cool.
Yeah. John, you've been at Parkland for a long time, 1980. What's the biggest change you've seen over time in any component that you want to talk about, whether it's curriculum, students, campus, higher education in general? What strikes you as the most interesting change over that period of time?
Well, in the class, we'll look at it two different ways. It bothers me that we have more and more regulation from outside of the college, from people who know nothing about education. And I think that frustrates you just as much as it frustrates
I would never say that out loud on a podcast, though.
Okay.
But you're absolutely right.
It's but you're glad someone else did.
Frustrating thing, I think, in the last...
As a old geezer, tenured, who doesn't really give a darn anymore, I feel I can come out and say that.
Yeah, it seems like it's easier or more welcomed or less pushed back against, maybe, to have, whether it's legislative or local or parental or... Mm-hmm. Whatever, somebody trying to insert their opinion into how things should work in their mind, mm-hmm. right or wrong.
Yeah, and it's oftentimes people who've never been in a classroom that are telling us how we should, you know, do mm-hmm. things. Yeah. In the classroom itself, the thing I still, it frustrates me, and I've tried all sorts of techniques to get students to change. I'm going to say that 80 to 90% of my students don't take notes. And maybe I get a small percentage who do something on some little, what I jokingly call flat thing. So they sit there and type in something. And from what I read, there are different pathways in the brain that use electronic things than when you write things. It's just like they have found that when you're talking to someone and you're driving, it is different than when you're on a phone talking to someone and you're driving. You use different pathways. It distracts you more to be on the phone talking to someone than it is to talk to someone who's in the front seat with you. Okay? And so they have found that it is, you learn a lot more by writing the stuff down than you do by keyboarding it in. And I try to tell students, I say, look, I will give pop quizzes in here and I will let you use your notes on the pop quiz if you want to, and they still won't take notes. This loss of note take, I don't know if it's part of the fact that they don't write cursive anymore and they can't keep up with the lecture or whatever, but it really frustrates me that students don't feel that the lecture is important enough to, because many times it is additional supplemental material above and beyond what is in the book, and they need to know it, but they don't feel it's important enough to take notes for. And is part of that personal, because that's their, you know, am I interpreting that they're saying that my lecture isn't important? You know, maybe there's a personal part to that. But part of it is just educationally, they are not taking, and this can be my anatomy class, this can be the forensics course, we'll see what happens when I start doing the flight physiology, because each course that comes from a different program has its own personality. So the forensic, which has a high component of criminal justice students, has a different personality than the anatomy class, which is mostly going to be nursing or clinical type students, and will now have a third component to compare to, and that'll be the flight students from out there, and we'll see, is there any difference there? I like comparing subsets of students and see how they do that.
So you started in 1980, right?
Full-time. I started part-time in 78.
Okay. Now, if I'm not mistaken, you're not only the longest-serving full-time faculty member, you're the longest-serving full-time employee, period, right?
Very well could be.
I did a quick scan through the back of the catalog today. You know, mm-hmm. shows the starting year. I didn't see anybody started before 1980.
You know, there's people around who are emeritus or the equivalent of it. John Leap is still around and stuff like that. And
he's still teaching full time.
Is he full time?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Okay,
mm-hmm.
then he might.
He started after you.
Oh, he did.
I think so.
Oh,
yeah.
Okay. So I might be, because I thought that Sue Loy was the longest serving until she bailed out, and mm-hmm. then I thought I was next after her.
But so that's 40 years, right? If I did my math right. Okay. So that's a long time. As you've had a lot of students. I wouldn't ask you to estimate your number of students, because that's, you know,
thousands.
Math on the spot. But in those years with all those students, have there been any students that have just really interesting stories. They've gone on to do something really unique, or they just have a great story behind them.
You know, off the bat, I can't think of a specific one other than the fact that it really does me good, you know, especially with the forensics. The students who come in with one major get hooked on the forensics and just change. You know, I have students that have gone down and started their bachelor's in forensic anthropology down at the Body Farm, and because they just got into this stuff and they just really, really loved it.
That's cool.
And, you know, again, that's really cool. The other thing that's kind of neat is there is now a beginning field in nursing called forensic nursing. And so what this deals with is the fact that when someone comes into the emergency room, you know, number one, if they've been shot, you have to have the chain of evidence in terms of when that bullet comes out of them. It has to be controlled in a certain way. It has to go into the evidence bag. It has to do all this other stuff. There's the surgical aspect of it. There's the collection of, is there a rape kit? Is there this, that, and everything else? And so I'm kind of pleased that almost every year for the past maybe 3 years, at least one and sometimes both semesters, I have some of my previous Bio 122 nursing students or pre-nursing students who are then coming on and taking the forensics course because they are at least seeing the possibility down the road that they might want to go into forensic nursing. So I like seeing that overlap. And part of it is you also pick up, for lack of a better term, groupies in sometimes students.
Forensic groupies.
Well, or just students who like the way you teach. And just like there are students who can't stand the way a certain instructor teaches, there are students who just love the way a certain instructor teaches. So part of it might be that as well. I think that's kind of nice is when you pick up students that cross over and yeah. And they're going to have a background that down the road might give them some flexibility. And who knows, down the road, that might be the one thing when, you know, I'm on a search committee now for somebody in nursing. And who knows, when you get down to the point where you're down to two possibilities, you know, and is there one thing that makes this person stand out different than that person? And who knows, it might be the fact that, well, gee, you know, this person does have some forensics training.
Sure. Yeah.
And I know that in terms of law enforcement for the criminal justice, if you're being hired by a small department, four people or five people out in the middle of Podunk or something, the fact that they have taken Psi 108 and Psi 208, that one officer may end up being the entire forensics department for that little department. And that may be the difference as to whether they get hired and someone else doesn't. And so it might be the same thing down the road for nursing.
Do you like to eat at the Waffle House?
Oh, we're going to tie our podcast episodes together with the Waffle House. Is this what?
we had a big Waffle House theme last week.
Okay.
And this one was very skull themed, so we'll have to tie the next one.
Oh, okay.
Are we doing more of these, by the way?
Well, I think we are. I think we're planning on doing a couple more. John, we're going to give you the last word here in a minute, but
okay.
We're wrapping up. We're coming up on just about an hour, and we're trying to keep it to okay. about that because somebody says
it's been a pleasure.
Attention span is about 60 minutes.
Okay.
Actually, it's about 10 minutes, but we'll expand it to 60.
I know. I teach. I understand that.
For the three of you still listening, thank you.
Anything else that you'd like to add in before we sign off for
this week? No, it's been a pleasure. You take a typical teacher and you get them started on talking, you can't stop them, you know. So, you know.
What's next? What's next for John Moore?
I am really, really, really looking forward to that flight physiology course.
Very good.
The first semester scares the hell out of me, to be honest, because I don't know how to fit stuff into how much time I'm going to have.
Sure.
You know, anything else, I can tell you what I need to do to make it longer, make it shorter. This is going to be new. And so the first time, you know, it's been, Psi 208, it's been, I think, 2006 when we started that. It's been that long since I started.
Probably the felt the same way then.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then prior to that, it was the pathophysiology course, which was back in 1990.
It's kind of exciting. It keeps pushing off that retirement.
Well, you know, and again, when you've been here 40 years, you need something new to keep you going.
That's great.
Yeah.
That's fabulous.
Yeah.
Thanks for joining us.
Glad to be here.
We appreciate it. Thanks to my friends here in the studio, such as it is. And thanks to our listeners, really, for tuning in and listening to the last podcast, hopefully this one. We'll hope you will join us for the next one, which is probably about 2 weeks away. Another clearly unscripted conversation with the people who are at the heart of Parkland College. Have a great day.